Hi, everybody. Today's Thursday, August 14th, 2025, and our friend Alex Craner is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you for the invite, Nima. Always good to join you.
Alex, I can confess that you're the only guest that maybe you're still positive about what's going on. Is that the case? About... Before going to your answer about what's going on between the United States and Russia and the meeting that would happen in Alaska, in Alaska, and the way that Donald Trump sees that, considering all these pressures going to Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin about the meeting, here is what Donald Trump said. I think we can have some sort of idea what he's thinking of.
Any consequences if Vladimir Putin does not agree to stop the war after your meeting on Friday?
Yes, they will. Yeah.
What will the consequences be?
There will be
sanctions, tariffs?
There will be, I don't have to say, there will be very severe consequences, yes.
How were your calls this morning with European leaders, and was it your call not to invite President Zelensky to your meeting with Putin?
No, just the opposite. No. We had a very good call. He was on the call. President Zelensky was on the call. I would rate it a 10, you know, very, very friendly. I know the leaders because I was at NATO, as you know. I took it from 2% to 5%, 2% that wasn't paid, 5% that is paid, which is trillions of dollars in defense capability. No, it was always going to be I was going to meet with President Putin, and then after that I'm going to call the leaders and President Zelensky. I'm going to call President Zelensky, and then I'll call probably in that order the leaders. There's a very good chance that we're going to have a second meeting, which will be more productive than the first, because the first is I'm going to find out where we are and what we're doing. Again, this is Biden's war. This isn't my war. He got us into this thing, and it should have never happened. This war would have never happened if I were president. But it is what it is, and I'm here to fix it, and I'm here to stop 6,000, 7,000 people last week. 7,213 people last week were killed, mostly soldiers. But missiles being lobbed into towns don't exactly help either. But mostly soldiers, and Ukrainian and Russian. They're not American soldiers, but you know, if we can save a lot of lives, it would be a great thing. I've stopped five wars in the last 6 months. And on top of that, we wiped out the nuclear capability of Iran, obliterated it. It's turned out to be a correct word, by the way, because, you know, some of the press said, well, maybe it wasn't obliteration. It was obliteration. We're going to meet with, I would say, the second meeting. If the first one goes okay, we'll have a quick second one. I would like to do it almost immediately. And we'll have a quick second meeting between President Putin and President Zelensky and myself, if they'd like to have me there. And that would be a meeting where maybe it could be absolutely work. But the first meeting will not work that out. Certain great things can be gained in the first. It's going to be a very important meeting. But it's setting the table for the second meeting. I think the second meeting, if the second meeting takes place. Now, there may be no second meeting, because if I feel that it's not appropriate to have it because I didn't get the answers that we have to have, then we're not going to have a second meeting.
Do you believe you can convince him to stop targeting civilians in Ukraine?
Well, I'll tell you what, I've had that conversation with him. I've had a lot of good conversations with him. Then I go home and I see that a rocket hit a nursing home or a rocket hit an apartment building and people are laying dead in the street. So I guess the answer to that is no, because I've had this conversation. I want to end the war. It's Biden's war, but I want to end it. I'll be very proud to end this war along with the five other wars I ended. But I guess the answer to that is probably no.
So, Alex, I think he talked about everything that somehow circulating in his mind. Your take on what would happen or what may happen by this meeting?
I don't know. I think that the first meeting will not produce any very significant results. That is, I don't expect that something very, very significant will be announced. But, you know, going back to the really important question, whether I still am positive about what's going on or not, I am. And I'll explain why. We are in the blizzard of PSYOPs. And I see that very many people, even people who are very learned, very experienced, and are paying very keen attention to events, are not sure what's going on. They have a hard time deciphering the events, particularly in Donald Trump's intentions. And so I think that what's really important to keep in mind always as the foundation for any kind of an analysis is the very accurate characterization of the conflict going on in the world today as a conflict between two systems of governance. And that's not, I didn't invent this. This was repeated by many Western officials and decision makers and leaders, including George Soros and Kurt Walker of, you know, former U.S. Ambassador to NATO. And they characterize it as democracies versus autocracies. I think it's the truth behind it is that it's a Western colonialist system versus everybody else. And Western colonialist system is something that has a 500-year continuity, and its origin is Western Europe. And still to this day, it's spiritual, it's strategic, it's philosophical headquarters is still Western Europe, the city of London in particular. And so the logic of this conflict imposes on anybody involved that you have to choose sides. You can't be mostly on one side, but a little bit on this side. You have to be either completely in the colonialist camp or you have to be completely against it. And so I think this is where Trump is. He's either on one side of this conflict or he's on the other side. Because, you know, let's say if he, let's take Israel, for example. So Israel is completely the product of Western colonialism. It's a colonialist settler project set up by the British Empire in its you know when its last incarnation was dying, and they prepared the ground for the creation of Israel starting in the second half of the 1800s of the 19th century. Then we had Balfour Declaration. We had Sykes-Picot, you know, drawing of the maps in the Middle East, creation of artificial nations. In 1916, we had Balfour Declaration in 1917. And then we had the creation of Israel in 1948. And so now, you know, it may appear that Trump is, you know, the United States government is completely devoted to Israel, that it's a make Israel first, make Israel great again kind of administration, that Israel is more important than the United States. That's how it appears. I do not trust those appearances because it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Israel is dying. Israel is at the end of its rope. Again, you know, remember Henry Kissinger, 2012, he said, 10 years from now, there will be no more Israel. It's not just Henry Kissinger. It was all 17 U.S. intelligence agencies made a major study on the question of Israel. And in 2012, they published an 82-page report, which came to an unequivocal conclusion that the interests of Israel and the interests of the United States are practically polar opposites, that, you know, it doesn't work. The reason why they keep the appearance of supporting Israel is because domestically they have a very important, very powerful, and very, very fanatical voting bloc devoted to Israel, and you can't go against them. you know, you can't take them head on and to say, like, you know what, your precious Israel, we're just going to flush it down the toilet. So you have to go through the motion of pretending to support Israel while allowing it to drown, giving it time, giving it the rope that they need to hang themselves with. And case in point is exactly Iran's nuclear program. And Trump's, as you showed in this video, Trump's umpteenth time insisting that the correct word for what happened was that the nuclear program was obliterated. Why is he saying that? The reason why he's saying that is because Iran's nuclear program was exactly the same issue as weapons of mass destruction in Iraq in 2003. It creates a justification and a pretext, but the nuclear program itself is not the objective of Western military intervention. The objective is regime change. Trump doesn't want regime change. So he is effectively saying, I have obliterated your justification for war on Iran. It's no longer there. We have no reason to go to war against Iran anymore. And so everything stopped on one missile attack, one bombing raid. And then a very symbolic, very polite retaliation by Iran, which made it obvious that they talked to each other, that they said, look, very sorry, we have to do this. It's going to happen in 48 hours, so please move anything valuable out of the way. We're going to drop a couple of bombs. We're going to declare victory. We understand you have to retaliate, but please let us know so we can, you know, we can make sure that there are no casualties. Iran has the power to wipe out all 22 American military bases in the Middle East and to sink their aircraft carriers. They didn't do that. They destroyed a radar station in Qatar, which was, you know, a very, very accurate, very effective strike, but with pre-announcement so that all the troops could be moved out of the way. So that all the troops could be moved out of the way and they sustained no casualties. Okay, so now we go to Ukraine and the upcoming summit in Alaska. It's been obvious since 2016 that Trump wants to improve American relations with Russia, and that is one of those fault lines where either you want to work with the Russians or you want to destroy Russia, because the empires, the colonialist system of governance cannot tolerate a rival. So they've been, for more than 200 years, they've been completely obsessed with destroying Russia. What is Trump doing? He's talking to the Russians. He's meeting with them. He has had, I think, at least 7 telephone conversations with Vladimir Putin since he took power. Compare that to 0 diplomatic contacts between Biden administration and the Russians. Since 2022, they did have diplomatic relations in 2021, but none since the war in Ukraine started. So Trump is doing, by the conduct of his policy, the actual conduct, the actual effect of his measure, he's showing that in that divide between two systems of governance, he has turned course away from this globalist empire, from this colonialist system of governance. And if you listen to the rhetoric, if you listen to his statements to the press, the public declarations, then it all seems very confusing. But I think that's part of the psyops. And there's reasons, there are reasons for those psyops, you know, because there are the whole post-World War II period and pretty much the whole 20th century, the United States has been allied with the United Kingdom and, you know, with the European allies. And, you know, that has been entrenched into the mindsets of not only the policymakers in the United States, but also in the public. It's become a cultural fact. And so you're not going to just for more than 20 years now, for practically 20 since 2003, for 22 years now, Russia and Vladimir Putin have been demonized in the United States and generally in the West, nonstop, 24/7, no zero nuance. It's Vladimir Putin is evil. He's a murderous thug, an autocrat, a dictator. He kills journalists, and on and on and on. And he's going to overrun Europe. Blah blah blah. And so you know, Trump can't come out and say like, "Hey, I'm just going to flush all our European allies, all these wonderful people in the West, down the toilet, and I'm going to make friend with this evil dictator." You know, it doesn't quite work. He can't do that quite exactly the same way. So therefore, you need psyops, misdirection, deception. Look, it was just very short time ago, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago, that he was saying how terribly disappointed he is with Vladimir Putin. But now he's invited Vladimir Putin to Alaska for a meeting. And what does that tell you? Well, it should tell you that their staff, and this is another thing what I have to say, I've been correct, because I've been saying that I think that the contacts, that the cooperation and the coordination of policy between the Trump administration and the Kremlin is far more extensive than we know. And then we found out from Marco Rubio that there have been a series of secret meetings between the two sides. They didn't tell us what it's about. All they tell us is we want unconditional ceasefire. I don't think that's the truth, because unconditional ceasefire is so obviously unacceptable to the Russians that, you know, this has been going on since the beginning of Trump administration with General Kellogg, right? He's been going on with this, we have to get the Russians to accept unconditional ceasefire. That would be like if you're in a boxing ring and you're beating your opponent to a pulp, and then somebody says, no, stop, we have to stop the fight. We're going to continue the fight in 1 month's time, but now you have to stop. Of course, the side that's winning doesn't want that. They want to finish the fight there because they're already winning it, maybe another few punches and it's all over. Whereas if you give them a month, they will recover, they will train themselves up, they will maybe rethink their strategy and their positioning. And so you've practically given up on your hard-won victory. That is so obvious that I think it's impossible that people in the Trump administration, if they have brains, if they have even average IQ, that they would be insisting on unconditional ceasefire and making that a condition for talking deals with the Russians. So obviously the fact that they keep talking about this unconditional ceasefire is a psyop. Well, obviously, it's not obvious, but that's how I perceive it. Because it's too stupid otherwise. It's just so spectacularly stupid that I cannot take it at face value. So my inclination is to think there's a different kind of a deal going on behind the curtains, behind the scenes. And so the fact that they're going to be meeting in Alaska is very, very significant. And my understanding is that the initiative to invite Vladimir Putin to Alaska is from Donald Trump's camp, from his administration. Now, last week I met with one of Croatia's leading military strategists, Admiral Domazet, and he has led the Croatian army through our war in the 1990s. And so I was curious as a military person his opinion about this. And the first thing he said, when the summit was announced, and they didn't say where yet, He said, soon we're going to find out the place, and the announcement of the place is going to be a very, very important message to the world. That's very important, where the place is going to be held. They said Alaska, right? We didn't guess Alaska at the time, but, you know, we were pretty sure it wasn't going to be anywhere in Western Europe. And so what does that tell you? That should lay to rest all those narratives that are talking about, you know, people in the Trump administration being stupid. They don't know what the hell they're doing. They're all over the place. It's chaos. I don't think that's the case either, you know, because the choice of Alaska is extremely significant, not only because that's where the two continents come together, where, you know, Russia and United States share a border, actually, and Alaska used to be Russia, that the Russians, for a very strategic reason, sold to the United States. It's also where, for the past 150 years, there have been projects proposed and studied to connect the two countries together physically by drilling a tunnel underneath the Bering Strait. And this has been proposed by Vladimir Putin as recently as 2014. And in 2009, when he was, or 2008, I forget, when he was the prime minister of Russia, he approved a major infrastructure development project for Russia that part of it was bringing railways to the Chukotka Peninsula and make it so that it could be connected to the future tunnel that would connect Russia to the United States. And the Russians were proposing to pay 2/3 of that project of drilling that tunnel. And so part of the reason for wanting to do this is not only economic development, but also, I think it was in the words of Vice President, not William Wallace, FDR's Vice President, Henry Wallace, who said that this would be very important to cement the future of peace for the world. You know, physically connecting the two superpowers and bolstering trade and cooperation and mutual economic development, so that, you know, you start cultivating friendly relationship. That is the one thing that the other side, right? Again, I'm going back to the two systems of governance. That is the one thing that the other side, the European colonialist system of governance, has has been trying to derail for decades now. And if you remember Trump's first term, practically everything was put in motion to make it impossible for Trump to improve the relations between the United States and Russia. So, you know, to wrap up this whole answer, these measures, these developments, these talks are huge. Trump talking about being disappointed in Vladimir Putin, about how he's going to end the war, all of this, these are just misdirection, propaganda pieces directed at the Western audiences to make Trump look like he's tough, like he's imposing solutions and measures on Vladimir Putin, like he's the alpha male in that combination. And that's purely self-serving for his own political reasons. But the actual direction of policy development is very positive. And that's why I remain positive, even though I acknowledge that Trump is behaving in a very boorish way, that he is borderline vulgar in the way he talks about other people, other countries, and so forth, that it's very easy to dislike Trump at the personal level and then to distrust him as a president of the United States and the leader of the Western world. But nevertheless, you know, you have to try to slot him on this side or that side, of the great geopolitical fault line. And so if he is in the globalist camp, in the colonialist camp, that would be obvious. But it isn't obvious. What is obvious is that he's moving away from that, and he's trying to make deals not only with the Russians and with the Chinese, he's trying to make deals with the Iranians. And I think that he will persist in this. And, you know, long answer, but this is why I still feel positive about the policy direction of the United States under Trump.
So how you put the situation with Azerbaijan and Armenia in the whole picture?
Great question. Look, I think that Trump now has a piece of paper in his hands. And that piece of paper gives him a certain negotiating leverage with respect to Russia, with respect to Iran, and also with respect to Azerbaijan, Turkey, and Armenia. So he's just inserted himself there in the middle of it. And he's almost like the gatekeeper now by that piece of paper. Now, can the United States enforce that agreement? I don't think they can. But let's set that aside. There's a widespread assumption that Trump's position there will be antagonistic to Iran and to Russia. That's possible. And I'm sure that he's going to milk it for all that it's worth. You know, he's going to say like, hey, you know, you want to deal with us? We're going to need these following concessions and blah, blah, blah. He's going to try 100%, of course. But here's where I see a more likely scenario. I think it's aimed at Turkey. And I'll explain why. Because, you see, the United States is, people are kind of assuming that Turkey and the United States are allies because they're both in the NATO, and Turkey is the second largest military force in NATO after the United States. And it's a big country. It's a powerful, important country, blah, 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 all of these things. But if you look at the statements coming out of the Trump administration for the last 6 months, they're practically in openly hostile terms with Turkey. I think the United States is very upset with Turkey over the taking down of the Bashar al-Assad regime. Because as we now know, I think you and I have discussed this before, but the fall of Bashar al-Assad's regime in the space of 9 days in December of last year was a big mystery, because a proper military of 250,000 troops with an air force, with tanks, with heavy artillery, with fortifications in strategic places and so forth, folded in the space of 9 days to a force of maximum 30,000 jihadis armed with light weapons and on pickup trucks. They raided the country, and then they got all the way to Damascus and met almost no opposition. And so I thought, this just can't be. This must be some kind of a trap. And so it turns out that very probably the decision was made by the Russians, that they gave the order Syrian Arab Army's generals to just simply not put up any resistance and to evacuate. And so what I know now is that, we knew this before, that part of the Syrian Arab Army evacuated to Iraq, but I also learned that part of it evacuated to Iran, and that they're still there, and that they are still a viable fighting force waiting for the right moment to go back to Syria. And so what we also learned recently is that the Turkey, which controls HTS, has been completely working on this project in cooperation with the British intelligence. So, you know, the Turks were in charge of HTS and the military assault, but the British are in charge of the strategy and you know, the the let's call it the policy aspects of the whole project. Meanwhile, the United States remains allied with the Kurds, not the Turks, not the HTS, with the Kurds. And Kurds are mortal enemies of the Turks. So the and then also, you know, there's still remnants of the Free Syrian Army that are backed by the United States, which are also at odds with HTS. So it's a huge giant mess. Now, how did this mess happen, and how did the Brits get the Turks to incubate HTS and turn against Syria and Bashar al-Assad's regime? They promised them support for the Greater Turania Project. And the Greater Turania Project is meant to unite in some way the all the Turkic people. That goes, you know, it's all the stans across the Central Asia, all the way to Turkey. So you have Turkey, then you have Armenia, and then you have Azerbaijan, which is a Turkic country. And then you have, you know, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and all the way to China, it's Turkic people. That's the Greater Turania Project. And so Erdogan, I think, was seduced by the idea that he might emerge as the great uniter of the Turkic people across Eurasia. And that would put him in an extremely powerful position as a gatekeeper of Eurasian integrations. And I think that this is what the British intelligence used to seduce him to back their colonialist project for the Middle East. And in fact, I think this is not even a conspiracy theory. You know, the head of the MI6. I think he's still the head of the MI. There's an incoming new head of the MI6, the woman, I forget her name, but up until very recently, or up until now, the head of the MI6 has been Sir Richard Moore, right? Sir Richard Moore was the British ambassador in Ankara for a few years, I think about 4 years' time. He speaks fluent Turkish. He is close friends with Erdogan. And he has been the one trying to recruit Turkey into their, not only their Middle Eastern project, but also their Ukraine project. You know, they really wanted Turkey to make part of the coalition against Russia together with Ukraine, which, you know, thanks to the very skilled diplomacy on the Russian side, they managed to sideline Turkey and keep them out of that war. Well, for the most part, but they did proceed with the Syria project along with the Brits, and this, I think, has vexed the Americans very much, and now they are on hostile terms with the Turks, and so now this whole project of uniting the Greater Turania has a weak link, which is the land corridor between Turkey and Azerbaijan, which is called the Zangezur Corridor. And so now, by inserting yourself exactly there, you're now in a position to be the gatekeeper, which means that you have the Turks by the short hairs, because the whole Greater Turania project hits a brick wall at that point. Unless the Americans say go. But what concessions are they going to ask to allow that Greater Turania project to go ahead? I think it's really put the Turks in a very embarrassing position. And you know, one thing I've also observed over the last few months is that Turkey has kind of vanished from the headlines. You know, there's this flurry of diplomatic activity going on between Azerbaijan, Armenia, Iran, China, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Russia, Saudi Arabia. Everybody's flying all over the place. They're meeting, they're holding summits, they're signing treaties, they're doing stuff. Nobody seems to be talking to Erdogan. The Chinese are not going to Ankara. Erdogan's not going to China. He's not going to Moscow. The Russians are not traveling to. Nobody's talking to the Turks. The Americans are not talking to the Turks. So it seems to me that Turkey bought into a cockamamie, insane British military misadventure in Syria. And the result has been that they find themselves isolated. And so when the Americans insert themselves to take control of the Zangezur corridor, I think they're going to use that leverage to obtain concessions from Iran and from Russia. But I think that the move was actually targeted against Turkey.
Alex, you mentioned Israel and the British project in the Middle East. I assume that they want to do the same in Ukraine. There is no end in their mind to the conflict in Ukraine. They want to continue it as long as it takes. And on the other hand, what's positive, in my opinion, about Donald Trump, he doesn't have that much patience to continue with a conflict that there is no end to it, you know? Because when you look at Donald Trump and the way he talks, it's so much unbelievable. You know, he brags about the Nord Stream pipeline, that he wasn't part of that. And I don't know why you need to do that. He doesn't look good in the eyes of other leaders, you know. The people, you may consider the situation in the United States, but in the eyes of Chinese, Indians, Russians, Iranians, all these leaders, they don't see this as, you know, when he talks this way, somehow they legitimize his argument, you know. It's not a good sign for international relations. But we know that Donald Trump doesn't want to continue. He doesn't see the benefit coming out of the war in Ukraine for the United States. He wants to sell more weapons to Europeans. Yes. But on the other hand, he doesn't want the war. You know, he's somehow in the middle of, you know, pressure coming from Europe is doing, by the way, all of this is because of the continuation of the conflict in Ukraine. It's not because Europe is concerned about the security. It's all about, it's nonsense, in my opinion. And how do you see that? How do you see Donald Trump managing that? Do you see the guy is capable of doing this?
I'm sorry, Nima, just to be clear, capable of doing what?
Capable of managing, you know, keeping Europeans and selling the weapons to Europeans, but after all, making some sort of deal in Ukraine that makes the situation impossible to send those weapons to Ukraine to continue this conflict. I assume that the British and those people who are running the show in Ukraine, they want the continuation of the conflict, as we saw it as we've been seeing the situation in the Middle East with Israel. How do you see that? Because it's all about more 3 years, 3.5 years, Donald Trump would be in power in the United States. Because in my opinion, what the European leaders are doing, it's beyond that. They're planning they're planning what would happen in the aftermath of Donald Trump. What do they have in their mind? In my opinion, it's all about the next president of the United States. Nobody knows who's going to be, but maybe J.D. Vance, he's going to continue the same policy. But they're somehow hoping that they can continue the conflict in Ukraine.
Yes, that's correct. And I think that Trump certainly believes that he can manage all this. And I think that he's probably right about that, because, you know, I think something you said is exactly right, that it's about his power at home. And I think that the critical, you know, he's already made himself a lot more powerful than he was in the previous, in his first term. partly by passing the big, beautiful bill, partly by, bringing Elon Musk to his side and X changing hands from, the globalist to a different manager. We have basically X is now the leading source of news for many people around the world. So, he's less vulnerable to the propaganda effect. Then I think that another score has been the outing of the Russiagate documents. And I think that a very, very important lever of power are the Epstein files, which, the administration has in their hands. And I think that they opted, instead of releasing it to the public, to use it as a political leverage. And then, this week, over the weekend, he took control of Washington, D.C. He put the control of the security of Washington, D.C. under the federal government. So the mayor and the Metropolitan Police in Washington, D.C. are now controlled by the Attorney General and by extension by Trump. And so he has very much consolidated his political power in a much more robust way than he did in his first term. Well, I mean, in his first term, he simply didn't. So he was being constantly 24/7 attacked, not only in the media and demonized ad nauseum, but he was also being constantly attacked through lawfare, these endless impeachment proceedings and trials. And so he was politically very, very weak. This is not the case anymore. But the key moment will be the midterm elections. So they need to, the Republicans loyal to Trump need to retain control of the House of Representatives and the Senate. And I think that this is part of the reason why Trump is going around making himself the winner in every situation. And, he's, making peace here and there, improving the economic performance in the United States. And all of these things that he's constantly very boastful about. I think that's aimed at further consolidating his political position at home. And that is, I think, from his point of view, the most important priority for his government. I think that the leaders in Russia and in China and elsewhere understand this. They're not stupid. And so they understand that a lot of his bravado, a lot of let's call it boorish pronouncements to the public, to the press, they serve this purpose. And I think that they don't care. Vladimir Putin doesn't take offense. He doesn't care what people say about him. They've been demonizing him for 23 years now in the Western press. I don't think Xi Jinping cares either. But what they sign on the paper, what deals they make with the United States, that's very important. And I know people will say, like, well, the United States is not agreement capable, and you can't trust them as far as you can throw them, and so on and so forth. But having a deal is better than not having a deal, because a deal gives you at least some leverage. Yeah, maybe some future administration is going to come in and they're going to say, we don't recognize this, we're walking back out of this. But there's a lot to be done, and there's a lot to be gained for all sides, not only in terms of economic development, trade, scientific, cultural exchange, and all of these things, and peace, but also in terms of nuclear disarmament, which is another thing that Trump has mentioned a few times, and people in his administration. And it is clear that they are, whatever deal happens between the United States and Russia, they're going to be working out some kind of a nuclear disarmament deal in the future. And so I think these are very, very important things. And I think that he will be able to manage it because his key counterparts aren't, paying attention to the psyops and the pronouncements that are aimed at domestic audiences. They're paying attention of what's being brought to the table and what's being discussed. And the fact that they're meeting in Alaska tomorrow, on Friday, right, for 15th August, tells you that they've already agreed on a lot of important points. Otherwise, you know, Trump and Putin wouldn't be meeting to say like, hey, you know, like, what are we going to do? This is all so messy. Their delegations, their representatives have already discussed a lot of these things extensively. And the fact that they were able to put this summit on so quickly tells you that they found it easy to agree on some very, very important issues that are important both to the Russians and to the Americans. And I think that to Western Europe and to the British, the only thing that's important is Ukraine. And this is why, when it comes to the issues in Ukraine, Trump is pronouncing a whole lot of nonsense and bullshit, because he still wants leverage over Europe and the UK, meaning they want him desperately on their side. They want him desperately to remain on board on Project Ukraine. So they are willing to agree to almost anything, as we saw, you know, 2 weeks ago in Scotland, when Trump summoned Ursula von der Leyen and Keir Starmer, and Ursula von der Leyen agreed to $750 billion in energy trade and energy purchases, $600 billion in direct investments by the EU in the United States, an undisclosed but massive amount of US weapons that they're going to buy from the United States. And then the fact that these weapons go to Ukraine is almost irrelevant, in the sense that you can transfer all the weapons you want to Ukraine. If there's nobody to wield them, it doesn't do anything to change the course of war. Remember, the thing that was critical to the British with regards to Ukraine war was for the United States to provide a security guarantee to Kiev, that is, to a Western aligned government in Kiev. Trump didn't do that. He declined this outright. And this is the only thing that could conceivably change the course of the war. And how? Because the part of the plan was for the French and the British to insert their, you know, security forces, which they called them peacekeepers, then they called them reassurance forces, to insert them into Ukraine as a tripwire force. And then when the Russians destroy those troops, then to turn to the United States and say like, okay, now it's time for you to honor your obligation here. You said you were providing security guarantee. Our troops just got wiped out. You have to go and confront Russia. So that was the objective, was to bring the United States into the mix and then to escalate to a total war between United States, NATO against Russia. Trump said no. And this is the most important decision, because it completely removes any possibility of the United States of going directly to war against Russia. And then, you know, for the rest of NATO to take on Russia without the American security guarantee is basically a suicidal mission.
Alex, my concern is the way that Donald Trump was behaving so far. He sent Steve Witkoff to talk with Russians, and somehow suddenly he disappeared from the scene, and there was no talk between the United States. You said that Rubio was talking about the behind the scene, there were talking to each other, but what we've been witnessing, there was no official talks. Just Donald Trump said, we are leaving the scene. Ukrainians going to talk with Russians. Mostly they were talking about prisoners and all of these little issues. So in this video that he was talking about the meeting in Alaska, he said that the first meeting going to be between the United States and Russia. And he was talking about immediately the second meeting having Zelensky there, talking with the Russian president. So if they want me to be there, I would be there. You know, this is the problem, in my opinion. Why do you need to bring Zelensky in? You know, Zelensky doesn't want to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine. His survival is in the continuation of the conflict. Why do you need to bring Zelensky in your opinion?
I don't think you do. And I think this is another one of those things that are so stupid, I can't quite believe that that's what they're intending to do. You know, there are a few problems with Zelensky, and that one of them is that since May 2024, he is no longer the president of Ukraine. He's basically a military dictator. And, you know, it's very obvious that if you signed any kind of a treaty with Zelensky, some future administration could walk into the government and say, we don't recognize anything Zelensky signed because he was not legitimately the president of Ukraine, because Ukrainian constitution is very precise about the fact that president's term is 5 years and not a day longer, and it cannot be extended for any reason, and the presidential elections cannot be delayed for any reason whatsoever. War, no war, emergency, it's 5 years and that's it. And so the fact that Zelensky is still president, he's illegitimate. So it's a waste of time to discuss and sign anything with him. And this is so obvious that I'm sure that the American administration, the people in the administration, perfectly understand this. So why is Trump saying all these things? I think it's again a psyop aimed at the Western, at the leaders of the Western European nations, who are insisting that Zelensky must be included in these discussions. Why they don't explain exactly, but they just think that that's the way it should be, and they ignore the fact that Zelensky is completely illegitimate. I think that after the meeting, I suspect, and I have no evidence for this whatsoever, but I suspect that part of it is going to be that there must be a caretaker government, that Zelensky cannot sign any of this, that there will have to be a caretaker government. The legitimate representative of Ukrainian side could be the Speaker of the House, the leader of the parliament, because the Constitution of Ukraine allows for parliamentary elections to be postponed in case of a war emergency, not the president. So the Speaker of the House, you know, the equivalent of the Speaker of the House could be the legitimate leader of Ukraine. But then part of the deal could be the early elections. And then, you know, if it turns out that the United States backs Valery Zaluzhny as the new president of Ukraine, that'll be another signal that it's a deal between Russia and the United States. Because the British don't want Zaluzhny, really. They would prefer Poroshenko, or I'm not sure if they want Tymoshenko. What is her name? Yeah, I forget her name. Tymoshenko, the blonde, the petite blonde woman who used to be the prime minister.
Yulia Tymoshenko.
Yulia Tymoshenko. Yes. There, I think that the Brits are not so sure about Zaluzhny, but you know, we got that Vogue press, a photo op of Zaluzhny, which pretty much signifies that somebody is pushing him forward. And I've noticed that this all happened from the time that Trump was meeting with Starmer in Scotland. And so it seems to me that Trump is kind of exerting pressure for Zaluzhny to take over. And if that turns out to be the case, I very strongly suspect that that's a deal between Trump and Putin, that's part of that deal. And so I think that we'll find out all this. I wouldn't even waste any brain space on parsing Trump's statements. They're not, you know, he's not telling you the truth. This is misdirection. This is This is a deception, and I think it's aimed at the likes of Merz and Starmer and Macron and von der Leyen, so that they could still cling to the hope that daddy is still with them and that he will bail them out eventually, and that they should spend all their money on American weapons and spend 5% of their GDP on NATO and so on and so on. I think that's the reason for those. You know, I could be proven wrong, but another thing I wanted to add, because people often say, oh, you know, enough of this 5D chess that Trump is playing, because, you know, how could, you know, Trump being as shallow as he comes across as, he wouldn't be playing 5D chess in this way. You know, I'm giving him too much credit. I think that it appears as 5D chess to us because we have been systematically misinformed about what's really going on. If you're sitting in the halls of power in the government and you have, you know, your intelligence people telling you what's going on, who are on the ground in Ukraine, then this is not 5D chess. This is kind of mafia style dealing. This is, you know, all you need is street smarts. All you need is like a gangster mindset, and that's what you would be doing. The fact that it appears like 5D chess to us, you know, from the frog's perspective, doesn't make it 5D chess.
Yeah. Alex, I don't know if you heard Netanyahu talking about the greater Israel. He said that in his mind, and he's closer to that. Do you feel that, before going to that, here is what New Zealand's prime minister said about Israel.
What's happening in Gaza is utterly, utterly appalling. I think Netanyahu has gone way too far. I think he has lost the plot. And I think that, you know, what we're seeing overnight with the attack on Gaza City is utterly, utterly unacceptable. We are in the situation we're observing is utterly appalling. Utterly appalling. It is driving more human catastrophe across Gaza. You know, we have called as a community, we've worked together with other like-minded countries. We are a small country, a long way away, with very limited trade with Israel. We have very little connection with the country. But we have stood up for values and we keep articulating them very consistently. And what you have seen is Israel not listening to the global community at all. We have asked for, you know, humanitarian assistance to be delivered unfettered. It hasn't happened. We have said a forcible displacement of people and an annexation of Gaza would be a breach of international law. We have called these things out consistently, time and time again. You've seen New Zealand join many of our friends and partners around the world to make these statements, and he's just not listening. And so, you know, that is that's why, you know, what we've seen is, you know, an attack on Gaza City is a really serious issue, because we don't want to extinguish the pathway to a two-state solution.
Yeah, he literally summed up what is happening with Netanyahu. He doesn't care about anybody. He feels the way that he can achieve that before leaving his position in Israel. Even he said that he's going to attack Iran, doesn't matter if the United States wants to help them. How do you see Israel, Alex? How do you see, because everybody's talking about what Israel is doing in Gaza, and they're trying to say that we're winning and we're ready to attack Iran again. You're taking that.
You know, I don't want to judge the Prime Minister of New Zealand, because I don't know enough about him and what his positions were. But it's been nearly 3 years. It's been like something close to 670 days of this slaughter in Gaza. And all of a sudden, they are all finding this utterly, utterly appalling. It's been utterly, utterly appalling from day one. And most of the Western leaders have been falling over themselves to assert that Israel has the right to defend themselves. They're still going on that it's not famine, it's not a genocide, and so forth. So I don't even like to hear them pretending that they actually care and that they have a moral compass, because they don't. They are just now so embarrassed because the public revolt is reaching such staggering proportions that you cannot even talk with any kind of a nuance to defend Israel's actions. So far as Benjamin Netanyahu is concerned, you know, I think his priority is fighting for his political life. And, you know, this Greater Israel project is, I think, one compelling vision, if you're a Zionist, that keeps him relevant, because he's losing everywhere else. You know, they were supposed to clear out Gaza in the space of about 2 weeks. They were supposed to defeat Hamas. Israeli soldiers are still dying in Gaza at the hands of Hamas. So Hamas is still there, and they're a viable fighting force. They took down the leadership of Hezbollah, but Hezbollah is still there, and they're still a viable fighting force. And now they're on a collision course with Turkey. You know, this is the thing, you know, that Erdogan walked into the trap, took over Damascus, and now there's a conflict between the Turks and Israelis, which is escalating, and that neither side really counted on and neither side really wanted, but now it's there. And they set up a deconfliction zone, but on both sides there's a conviction that war is coming, that it's inevitable, that this confliction zone is too little, too late. And Israelis, in fact, upgraded Turkey as their enemy number one in the region, meaning Iran is no longer the enemy number one, it's Turkey. And again, I go back to, why is nobody talking to Erdogan? Why is Erdogan not talking to anybody? 2 days ago, we learned that Al Jolani has reached out to the Russians to ask their protection, to ask them to defuse the tensions between the, you know, the current jihadi government in Damascus and the Israelis. But why didn't Erdogan call Vladimir Putin for that reason? That's very, very strange that Erdogan is just like missing in action. And so I think that Israel is kind of circling the drain. Their economy is in shambles. The government is failing. Their troops are exhausted. Desertions are rising high. Iran's attacks have heavily damaged their infrastructure. And I think that all three of their large ports now are very, very heavily damaged. And the trade has dwindled down to a minimum. And now they're still active on 7 fronts, and they want to open the 8th one against Pakistan. It's going nowhere, and I think that Netanyahu is just trying to keep himself relevant and alive. And I just this morning I saw that he came out in public saying that his life is now being threatened. He's fearing for his life. And I think that reaching for the Greater Israel card is to kind of reassert his leadership and to ask people to believe in something that he's fighting for, even though he's not fighting for that. He's fighting for himself. He's just appealing to the most fanatical side of the Zionist settlers who are fighting for Greater Israel, you know. And so I see nothing but desperation from his part. And I don't think that the United States is going to be able to do anything to help Israel.
Alex, do you feel that the United States would be able to manage the situation with India? Because we know that they were trying to put pressure on India. Even the vice president of the United States said that we cannot go against China, but somehow we can deal with India. How is that going? This sort of game, if we assume it's a game on the part of the United States, how is that going to influence the Indians' foreign policy in a long run? Are they going to learn that the reality is somehow is BRICS, is the East, is somehow, you know, making the connection between these countries even better or improving the connection? How is that going to influence the Indian mindset, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's going to push India deeper into, you know, it's going to strengthen their commitment to BRICS. It's going to give them an incentive to make nice with China. You know, they've already patched up that relationship to a good extent, but it's going to give them more of an incentive to make nice with their neighbors and not rely on the United States. You know, India has been widely perceived as prevaricating between the BRICS and the multipolar integrations, and with and on the one side, and the Western world on the other side. And you know, usually that's the result of, you know, political realities at home. It's not necessarily that Modi is kind of like Erdogan, you know, guy who wants to sit on two chairs at the same time. But you know, you'll have part of the political spectrum who is very pro-West, and the other part that sees, you know, the writing on the wall and says, like, look, we have to, you know, we have to change course in our policy, because the West is going nowhere, and we're going to end up in all these wars that are being cooked up for us. And you know, again, the same reality that I mentioned for the United States, you have the mindset and vested interests and the positions that have been entrenched for decades, that you can't just dislodge like that by saying, okay, now we're going to be best friends with the Chinese, and we're going to, you know, completely neglect our relations to the United States and Western Europe. Because you have a lot of Indians who are in Western Europe, who went to, you know, Oxford and Cambridge, and you know, became kind of integrated into this Western system. You have many Indians in Canada, and so these liaisons still, to a large extent, determine the foreign policy conduct of Indian leadership. But I think that in a way, Trump is making them, you know, the pro-Western Indians, he's weakening their side and their arguments, and he's strengthening the arguments of those people who say, no, we need to completely commit to BRICS, we need to shift our commerce to away from Western financial system, away from SWIFT to these new emerging markets and the payment systems and new currency systems. And so I think in the long term, it's going to only strengthen the multipolar integrations at the expense of the Western Empire.
Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today.
Great. Thank you, Nima. Always a pleasure. We'll know a lot more after tomorrow, and then exactly. We'll talk about it
next week.
Yeah. Yes, we'll be a bit smarter.
Yeah, we're going to learn that, I think, by the first meeting between the two. Thank you so much, Alex. Have a great
time. My pleasure. Take care, Nima. Bye-bye.
See you soon. Bye-bye.